Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
You know, I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's a sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's February of 2018. A year and a month into the presidency of Donald Trump, and we're at the point where every piece of political news is analyzed through the prism of how it will affect the midterm elections. The Democrats have openings that they haven't seen in years, as we just saw with the election of Doug Jones in Alabama. And there's talk, though certainly very speculative, of Democrats taking majorities in both houses of Congress. But a question looms over the Democratic Party. Should it run moderates and try to grab unhappy swing voters, or should they run progressive candidates on the left to re-energize the party? And the Republicans at the same time face a mirror image of that conflict as they defend their majorities in Congress. Andrew Hall is a young political scientist who studies the dynamics of elections, and he's analyzed the data on why both parties seem to have been moving toward more extreme candidates. He spoke with Amy Davidson Sorkin, a political columnist for The New Yorker, to shed some light on the upcoming midterm elections.
Andy, what's your definition of an extremist candidate or a moderate candidate?
For the purposes of my research, we use a variety of statistical techniques to try to estimate the ideological positioning of different candidates. And if you're in a Democratic primary and you're farther to the left than the other candidates, then you're more quote-unquote extreme. If you're farther to the right, you're more quote-unquote moderate, and vice versa for in a Republican primary. So it's purely a relative measure and should not be thought to convey any value judgment.
But how do you tell, like Twitter use or rhetoric or voting record?
Yeah, so we use a variety. The main thing we use is a set of techniques that look at the composition of their campaign contributions. Huh. So let's say you've never served in Congress, you're running for Congress. We don't directly know much about you yet, but we can look at what other incumbents your donors gave to. And so if you got most of your money from donors who mostly donated to, say, far-right members of Congress, we're going to infer that you're a far-right candidate.
Huh.
That's sort of the core technique we're using.
So things that we think of in terms of extremism, like calling names, you know, grandstanding, things like that, you're sort of arguing are a lot of that is noise.
I think sometimes when people use the word extreme, they're really talking about that. And I think that's important, but separate. What I'm looking at in this research should be thought of specifically as extremeness in your ideological positioning, and we can use your contributions to measure that.
There's a debate going on in the Democratic Party right now about whether they should run moderate, middle-of-the-road candidates or candidates who might, for example, be more to the left and energize their base. You've done a lot of research on that. What does your research tell you about that choice?
Yeah, I would say my research is at the individual candidate level, very precisely. When you nominate, at least in congressional races, these more extreme candidates, they tend to do very badly on average in the general election. And so if you're thinking of this from the perspective of trying to win particular seats, it's not likely to be a winning strategy in the short run. That doesn't mean, I should stress, there are broader strategical perspectives from which it may be worth that cost. And that's a different question. So if you look, for example, at the Tea Party lost a lot of general elections because of their nominations from the primaries. That doesn't mean that the movement hasn't been successful in moving the party's ideology in a particular direction. So it is the case that the more extreme candidates outperform the more moderate candidates in the primary, but it's quite modest. and it's swamped by the general election penalty to these more extreme people. The other thing I would say, thinking sort of in the aggregate about why we see a bunch of what looks like extremism if there's this penalty, is that actually voters just don't get a lot of opportunities to vote for more moderate candidates because they just don't run for office very much. And
why not?
There's probably a lot of reasons. My argument, this is the subject of my book, which is coming out, is that it's just a very difficult and unpleasant job these days. So that leads these more moderate people who might have considered running for office to choose not to.
What makes it so hard? Do you mean hard in just a practical sense or hard because it's soul-killing or...?
A lot of reasons. The number one reason I would say is the difficulty of campaign finance. So if you want to run for the House today, you need to be prepared to spend most of your days dialing for dollars. And the vast majority of people, even the set of people interested in running for political office, do not enjoy that activity at all. So you layer that, I think, enormous cost, psychic and otherwise, on top of all the other costs, like giving up whatever job you currently have. And it makes it very difficult to make that choice. Then you think about, what are the benefits? Say you win. Say you incur all these costs and you win. What's your life going to look like once you're in office? Well, it turns out that seems to be a lot less attractive than it used to be. So one of, I think, the real motivations for running office used to be the chance to influence policy once you get into the legislature, to serve on important committees and be involved in drafting important legislation. And that opportunity has really dwindled in a world where now most legislation is highly centralized and run by party leadership. So I would say, from the perspective of my research, the thing we can most clearly measure and observe is that it is more extreme people who are systematically more willing to bear these costs. They're willing to spend all day dialing for dollars. They're willing to have a job where they don't have a lot of individual influence on the process because they really believe in the ideology that they're espousing, and that makes it more, they're more willing to bear the cost because of that.
Is it a bad thing to have candidates who are extreme, who really believe what they believe, who have a definable to voters set of beliefs?
That's a very hard question. That obviously goes back to how we're defining extreme, first of all. So under my definition, where I'm scaling these candidates and identifying who's relatively speaking more extreme than someone else, it seems bad only in the sense that these are not the people that general election voters seem to prefer. And so my argument in my book is, if we could get more moderate people to run for office, given how we see moderate people do in the general, voters would be happier if more moderate people ran.
Let's go back to the idea. Now, you have all these people who've decided to run for office for whatever reasons, whatever the cost. At what point does that become, you know, going back to the Tea Party, what point does that become a movement that moves the party, that makes the party itself more extreme?
Yeah, I mean, I think it can pretty quickly. So I think one of the things that I think is most interesting and difficult to understand about American politics is that in a lot of ways, there really isn't a party. We have such an open system of running for office that anyone can run for office and say they're a member of whatever party they want. And that gives the party a lot less control over their own brand than most other democracies. And so when you ask or you think about how does a party come to have the positions it has, sure, they craft a national platform, which nobody reads. They certainly try to recruit particular kinds of candidates and to help them by giving them resources. But at the end of the day, they are at the mercy of who will run for office for them. And they're at the mercy of who will win office. And so the party, what the party stands for, can change pretty rapidly if the set of people who run for office change. And I think that's part of what we've seen.
Well, the Trump presidency seems to have energized a lot of people who weren't previously involved in politics. And there's a sense that in 2018, there'll be a lot of candidates running for the first time. How does that interplay with what you're talking about here?
Yeah, I think that's a very big deal. And I think it's a big deal for at least two reasons. Number one is simply having more people run for office gets you a better chance of picking very good electable candidates and therefore maps directly to electoral success. Number two, it's a huge leading indicator of electoral success. People in general are pretty good at figuring out when it's a good time to be running for office in a particular party. So when you see a party fielding more candidates than usual, it's a good sign that people on the ground think these are winnable seats.
Now, one new group of potential candidates that have sort of emerged is women. Is there a gender aspect to this? If people look at the landscape and a lot of the discussions about women in the workplace and about Donald Trump and say, you know, this year I'm going to run for office, I'm going to run for something. How does that change all of these calculations?
I think it's going to be a huge story in 2018. I can just say as a general election scholar, the identities of candidates matter a huge deal. Like a lot of things in politics, I sound like a broken record at this point, who runs for office is probably the most important dimension. And historically, that has been one of the biggest obstacles to getting women into office has been that they don't run at as high a rate. And we're seeing, I think, changes in that direction.
So in a way, the real mistake is sitting around saying the Democratic Party should be doing this, should be doing that. Really, what the Democratic Party needs to be doing is figuring out who wants to run as a Democrat and how that person connects with voters either in a district or in the country.
That's certainly my view. And I would say, you know, that is something the parties are certainly cognizant of. They do try very hard to recruit candidates. And it's a very hard thing to do because it's a really tough sell.
Because it's just not that fun to be a member of Congress these days.
No, exactly.
All right. Thank you so much.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Andrew Hall is an assistant professor of political science at Stanford, and he spoke to The New Yorker's Amy Davidson Sorkin. It's The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
They shoot journalists on sight in the Capitol. They literally see us as enemy combatants.
In the new movie, Civil War, the United States is up in flames, and the truth teller is just another casualty.
The movie is using journalism as a lens to show you what happens when social trust breaks down completely.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Now, here's a fact, and a depressing one. A child born on the first day of the war in Afghanistan is probably a high school senior today. 17 years in, 100,000 Afghans are dead, ISIS and the Taliban remain powerful in the region, and trillions of dollars have been spent, and there's absolutely no end in sight. Steve Call wrote about the origins of the conflict going all the way back to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan in his book Ghost Wars, and for that he won a Pulitzer Prize. That book ends, though, on September 10, 2001, and Call picks up the story in his new book, Directorate S, which takes us from the destruction of September 11th right through to the present, and he focuses on what you might call the original sin of that war, what the American intelligence community got so wrong about Afghanistan. Steve, now the book begins where Ghost Wars left off, shortly before 9/11. And one reviewer, Mark Mazzetti, who won a Pulitzer for his own coverage of Afghanistan and Pakistan, said that reading your book was like watching a slow-motion video of a truck going off a cliff, frame by agonizing frame. In other words, the war in Afghanistan, as your reporting shows, was doomed from the outset. Why was that the case?
Well, I don't think we knew what we wanted to accomplish there after we overthrew the Taliban and tried to, you know, disrupt al-Qaeda immediately after September 11th. And that's one of the reasons why it was doomed. You had divided views in the Bush administration after the Taliban were overthrown. Should we just minimize our presence there and let the Europeans do the aid and reconstruction while we go off and invade Iraq? That was Rumsfeld's view. That was the one that ultimately prevailed. There were others who said, we need to really rebuild this place now while we've got a chance, while it's peaceful. And then as the years went by, you know, two things just kept repeating themselves. And I was aware, writing, that, you know, a problem with this narrative is that we just keep making the same mistakes over and over again and expecting different results. But two of them were blindness about Pakistan's intentions in Afghanistan. We really did not see the Taliban comeback coming. And it really, by 2006, when it really had revived the war and it was a serious insurgency, we were deep up to our, you know, elbows in Iraq.
Well, Pakistan's intentions are at the absolute heart of your book. Pakistan was supposed to be our closest military ally in the region. We supplied it with billions of dollars of military and economic aid, and yet, as the war dragged on, it became clear that Pakistani intelligence, the ISI, was quietly training and supporting Taliban fighters. Why in the world would the ISI be on the side of the Taliban? Why was that in their interests?
So there's an assessment of this question that the head of Afghan intelligence, a guy named Amrullah Saleh, did in the spring of 2006, one of the earliest kind of really thorough examinations. Why are they doing this? And he concluded that there were a couple of reasons. One was the Bush administration, you may remember, did a big nuclear deal with India. They basically forgave India for breaking out of the nuclear nonproliferation regime and started to supply them civilian nuclear equipment and fuel. And they told Pakistan at the same time, you're not going to get one of these deals. You're not reliable enough. You've smuggled nuclear goods around the world. And the Pakistanis took that and said to themselves, we need to take care of ourselves. The second thing was that the U.S. had effectively said, we're out of the Afghan war. And the Pakistanis said, look, we need to prepare for the next round of Afghan civil war. So they did this very quietly. But by the time you get to the end of 2006, it's quite evident what they're up to.
You title your book Directorate S, which is, I got to tell you, a very spy novel. It's fantastic and ominous title. But Directorate S is a real thing. What is it? And what was its influence in this whole picture?
Well, it's the covert action arm of the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. At least that's what the U.S. called it in U.S. documents. So the ISI is a very big organization, but this unit functions like the clandestine service in the CIA or the paramilitary division of the CIA. It's made up mostly of ex-special forces guys, and they build relationships with guerrilla leaders, Afghan guerrilla leaders, and without getting caught, try to provide them as much support as they can manage. They also work with other cross-border militants in the region, like in Kashmir.
There seems to be so many ifs inscribed in your narrative. If the United States had succeeded in rooting out al-Qaeda at Tora Bora and perhaps killed Osama bin Laden, if the Bush administration had negotiated on some level with the Taliban, if, did we know in real time that we were screwing up and being involved in a quagmire that would qualify as the longest war in American history?
You know, when counterfactual history obviously is kind of a mug's game, but I've thought about this a lot since I've spent so much time kind of watching the bus go off the cliff frame by frame. And I think if there was a time when we could have done a lot better, certainly we wouldn't have built a paradise, but we could have done a lot better. It was in that period 2002 to 2004.
And what would the conditions have been? How would it have gone better?
Well, first of all, we wouldn't have invaded Iraq, so we would have had all of our national resources and military resources and aid budgets and reconstruction budgets available for the war we had actually just fought and succeeded in. So that would have been the biggest decision. The second thing was, and there's episodes of it that are really, you know, discouraging in hindsight because of the hubris involved, which is every time you have a lightning strike victory in a conflict like the one in the fall of 2001, what does history tell you to do? It's, you figure out a way to incorporate the defeated in the political order that follows. Otherwise, they're just going to go back to war. And the foot soldiers of the Taliban movement were treated as if they were al-Qaeda hijackers. And the Taliban had not been involved in 9/11. So far as we know, we're not even sure their leadership knew about it. They had accommodated al-Qaeda. They were complicit in a legal or moral sense with the attacks. But any realistic assessment of the future of Afghanistan had to account for the fact that this movement had drawn from 50% of the population. They were destitute, poor as dirt. They needed a future. And the future we gave them was Guantanamo or go to Pakistan and try to get started again.
Another thing that entered the picture was torture. Beginning in about 2002, you describe the use of almost dystopian prisons and interrogation techniques in Afghanistan. Why did we do that?
I have no idea. I mean, there was a great deal of rationalization of this after the fact around the truth that the United States didn't know very much about where the next attacks were coming from and felt that interrogation and detention was the only line of reliable evidence that it could find. But, you know, by 2003, it was evident that there was really no al-Qaeda left in Afghanistan. And the people who were being detained were Taliban, you know, lieutenants or, you know, guerrillas in the mountains who were firing off rockets at U.S. bases. So what justifies really even a serious operation around that, but never mind torture?
So bin Laden, as we understand it, got from Tora Bora somehow to Abbottabad, which is, as we used to call it, the West Point of Pakistan. How did he live? Who protected him? What do we know about his life and arrangements in the years between Tora Bora and his final assassination?
Yeah, I really enjoyed kind of digging into what evidence I could get about that. I mean, what we know is, so he goes across the border in December 2001, and then from the records available, he kind of disappears for about 6 months, and then probably went north, and then he surfaces in a small town around Peshawar. And in the years between then and his killing in 2011, so about 5 years, you know, the United States has now translated and published hundreds and hundreds of letters that he wrote that they captured when they raided the house. In the letters, he's very scared of running into Pakistani security. At the same time, there's in the letters evidence that al-Qaeda is negotiating some kind of truce with the Pakistanis, not really clear
who's
doing it.
But the question has always been, how is it possible that Osama bin Laden is hiding out, as it were, in West Point?
Yeah. Well, after he was exposed, you know, everybody who came to Islamabad would go in to see the chief of the army or the chief of ISI and ask that question.
And
their answer was, we really are that incompetent. A very elaborate form of that answer. See, we didn't know that guy was there. We didn't know this guy was there. If we had known, we would have gone after them because they were killing us. We were really that blind.
One of the amazing characters in your book is the Afghan leader, Hamid Karzai, who after a while was portrayed in various ways in the press, both as torn between Afghanistan and Pakistan and the United States, as somebody who was wandering the presidential palace higher than Jerry Garcia. tell me about him and how his view of the United States changed and why that mattered.
Yeah, one of the things that I tried to do, knowing that, you know, a lot of impressions were out there about how people like him had evolved in their thinking and their behavior, I tried to get as many records of conversations with him over the years in private that had been carried out by visiting Americans or others, and really just kind of track them all the way forward. And what you see is two things that are not in the general kind of assessment of him, cliched assessment of him. One is every time when someone came to visit him, he said, "Why aren't you doing more about ISI? They're really destabilizing my country. You keep sending in counterinsurgency forces to go, you know, connect the people of rural Kandahar to my government. But what you really should be doing is going over and stopping ISI from running these Taliban operations How? Into Afghanistan." Well, by sealing the border, by, you know, attacking them directly, by using sanctions, by pressuring them, by whatever means, why are you not doing that? And, you know, by the time you get to the Obama administration, they were saying, well, we are, you know, we are. You may have noticed we have a drone war going on over there. But he really began to believe that, look, the sole superpower in the world doesn't want to put enough pressure on ISI to get them to change their behavior. Therefore, America wants ISI to destabilize Afghanistan so it can justify having military bases in the country for as long as it wants them. That it was a conspiracy theory. And once he started enunciating this, then Americans would go to him and say, you know, Mr. President, you've got all of the Snowden records. You've got all the WikiLeaks records. Can you see any mention of this design?
And I mean, as a colonial project.
As a colonial project. So this guy named James Dobbins has this conversation with him in 2013. You know, Mr. President, look at all these records. Can you see anything of this kind? He says, maybe you don't know about the plan. And he says that, you know, there is a deep state in America.
Wow.
And so
he could be on Fox News any night of the week. Now, President Trump is promising to freeze over $1 billion in aid to Pakistan. And this decision came shortly after he tweeted that Pakistan had, quote, given us nothing but lies and deceit and had provided a safe haven to the terrorists we hunt in Afghanistan. Is his basic assessment of the situation more or less correct?
Yeah, it's very easy to sympathize with his decision to withhold aid given Pakistani conduct. I mean, Pakistani conduct is more complex than his tweet suggests. They've also arrested a lot of al-Qaeda leaders. They've provided a lot of intelligence support, just not about the Taliban. But yes, I think I can understand that decision. The difficulty is that there have been other attempts to use sanctions to change Pakistan's conduct, and none of them have worked. And the scale of our aid now is less significant than it was 5 years ago, and it pales in comparison to what China's doing in Pakistan.
But yet again, we're sending more troops.
Yet again, we're sending more troops. I mean, this is the contradiction that recurs alongside the blindness about ISI and the narrative, which is, you know, new generals go out to command the war every year or two or every 6 months. And they all say there's no military solution to this war against the Taliban. And yet they recommend, and the White House again and again across three administrations decides to prioritize military action as if doing the same thing is going to lead to a different outcome. So
what does winning look like?
Well, winning looks like a reduction of violence. You know, people talk about the unwillingness of the Trump administration to engage in diplomacy. But, you know, when you talk about diplomacy, what you're really talking about is not some Paris peace accord where everyone agrees that they're going to enter peaceful politics, and that's not who the Taliban are. But there is negotiation and diplomacy that could potentially reduce the suffering of Afghan civilians and the scale of violence in the country. Let's not just bomb the way out of our problem. You know, we don't talk alongside the security strategies that we have, and it's frustrating because, you know, we do that in other settings. And remember the Obama administration's diplomatic achievements. They managed to hang in there with the European Union, Russia, and China to complete the Iran nuclear agreement. They reversed decades of stuck policy in Cuba and flipped that whole story around. So the United States is capable, along with others, of negotiating change in really complicated and stagnant problems, but it really hasn't tried in Afghanistan.
Steve, it is a great book and a definitive history now in the second volume of America's Longest War, and you've got more time to write for The New Yorker, so everybody's happy.
Understood.
Steve Call, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Steve Kahl is a staff writer for The New Yorker and dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. His new book is Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. Next week on the program, Jelani Cobb talks with Ava DuVernay. She's best known as the director of Selma, but her work takes a very different turn now with the upcoming release of A Wrinkle in Time, which is based on Madeleine L'Engle's great classic.
And he's trapped by a darkness that's actively spreading throughout the universe. And the only one who can stop it is you. Be a warrior.
I'll try.
You know, I feel something very deep in my gut when the Oprah's voice says, you know, there's a darkness in the world and the only one who can stop it, and smash cut to a black girl. Mm-hmm. And she is hopping planets and flying and like saving the friggin' world. She's like saving the world.
Ava DuVernay, next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick, and I want to thank you for joining us today. I hope I'll see you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Cal Alia, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Corey Schreppel, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.